Hey, welcome to the show. I'm John Wheeler, and you're listening to This Week in Nuclear. In the last 2 weeks, a fascinating series of events shows how the nuclear renaissance is taking the world stage in both business and politics. On December 6th, the Russian parliament approved an overhaul and consolidation of their nuclear organizations with the goal of enhancing centralized control and promoting global expansion. Then on December 9th, the U.S. Congress approved the U.S.-India nuclear cooperation deal and sent it on to President Bush to be ratified. And yesterday, on December 18th, a pair of events occurred. In the morning, we received word that China has awarded Westinghouse a contract worth upwards of $8 billion to build 4 AP1000 pressurized water reactors, a project that will create more than 5,000 jobs in the USA alone. And a few hours later, we got the word that U.S. President George Bush has signed the U.S.-India cooperation bill into law. The bill is scheduled to be debated in India over the next few days, where it does not have to be voted on the way it was in the USA. These are exciting times indeed. In Russia, the restructuring of their nuclear program brings all aspects of the nuclear fuel cycle under one umbrella controlled by the government. Mining, fuel manufacturing, plant construction, and operations, even decommissioning will fall under the new company called Atomenergoprom. The official party line is the reorganization will promote investment and facilitate growing the business. I have a little different take on it, though. I think this represents another example of the Russian government reinforcing its position as the dominant energy supplier in Europe and Asia. The Russians recognize that by controlling the energy supplies in the region, they'll have tremendous political and economic leverage. And here's an example. Belarus is planning to build a new nuclear plant to secure their energy future. That's great news, but in the wake of that announcement, Russia's state-owned gas monopoly, Gazprom, warned that it will quadruple the rates that Belarus pays for natural gas to $200 per 1,000 cubic meters. Then, after giving Belarus time to contemplate how that energy price increase would cripple their economy, Russia came back and offered to keep natural gas prices lower if Belarus turns over a controlling stake in the Belarusian gas pipeline supply system. Let's get this one straight. We're going to raise the rates you must pay, and it'll bankrupt your economy. But you have no choice because your people will freeze to death. Ah, but we have a deal for you. If you give us your gas pipeline, we'll give you a price break for the gas we send through it. That's nothing but blackmail, plain and simple. It also shows how the Russian government plans to take over the region's energy supply piece by piece and country by country. The nuclear restructuring further consolidates Russia's control over their nuclear energy industry and infrastructure so they can support their political ambitions of dominance over the region. Here's a story that came to light some time ago, but it's worth recapping because it's a great example of how local and state politicians in the United States are more than willing to bow to political pressure from anti-nuclear radicals. While it demonstrates that the new licensing process does work, it also shows how anti-nuclear groups will do everything they can to make nuclear power more expensive, even when there's no technical benefits to their claims. The North Anna Station is a two-unit nuclear plant in Virginia that was built in the 1970s. Unit 1 came online in 1978 and Unit 2 in 1980. The plant's owner, Virginia Power Company, who's the predecessor to present-day Dominion Energy, built a 13,000-acre lake to serve as a source of cooling water for the reactors. Originally, the North Anna site was intended to have 4 reactors, and the lake was sized to handle the heat load of all 4 power plants. But in the 70s and 80s, only 2 reactors were built. This put Dominion in a great position to add 2 new reactors to the site, and that's when the state stepped in. several anti-nuclear groups complained that the addition of the reactors at the site would cause lake temperatures to rise a few degrees, and that would affect the striped bass population of the lake. Other groups made claims that during periods of high heat loads, the lake level will drop, and that'll have a detrimental effect on recreational activities like boating and fishing. Here's where the injustice occurred. A state court ruled in favor of the anti-nuclear groups. The state ruling claims that in the years since the first North Anna nuclear plants came online, Lake Anna, as it's become known, has turned into a recreational resource for the people of Virginia, and as such, the utility could not add to the heat load of the lake. As a result, Dominion will have to construct cooling towers for the proposed new unit at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars. So let's recap this. The company built an artificial, man-made lake on land that they owned. The lake is only half used because it was sized for four reactors and only two have been built. But now, because the lake is nice for boating and fishing, the state of Virginia has decided that the utility doesn't have the right to use their lake for the purposes that they built it and permitted it by the state. As a result, the utility will have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to build a second cooling system. And worse, because the cooling water restrictions imposed by the state, the ruling makes it impossible to add a fourth light water reactor at the site. If a fourth reactor is ever built, it'll have to be a high-temperature gas reactor or another Generation 4 reactor that does not use water coolant. This restriction significantly reduces the value of the North Anna site for future energy development. Do you think the state intends to compensate Dominion for the additional expense or the loss of value of their lake or their site? Heck no. This one should have gone to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the utility decided it was not worth the political fight. They essentially allowed the state to confiscate half of their 13,000-acre lake, and they accepted the restrictions that prevent using the site as it was originally permitted. On the positive side, the new plant, if it's built, should be able to squeeze out a few additional megawatts with a cooling tower as opposed to once through cooling to the lake. In the last couple of weeks, there's been a flurry of new nuclear plant announcements in nations with developing economies. Nigeria, Belarus, the Bengal region of India, and Indonesia have all announced they plan to build new nuclear plants. And these come on the heels of announcements by five Arab states last month. The plant in Indonesia will be a small Russian barge-mounted reactor, but the designs that are going to be used in the other locations have not been decided. These are the kind of announcements I really like to see because nuclear energy will give these countries a domestic source of emissions-free energy, good-paying jobs for the people, and a stable supply of electricity that'll raise their standards of living. Nigeria has a total electrical generation capacity of 6,000 megawatts, but they typically only have about one-half of their capacity because of frequent breakdowns in their generation and transmission systems. They say they want to add up to 4,000 megawatts of nuclear generation. But if they're going to do that, they're going to have to invest in improving the reliability of their transmission and distribution systems. Even if a small nuclear plant has the capability to run at full load, if they can't get the power reliably to the customers, they'll have to run at reduced output. This reminds me of a question I received this week from a listener named Avram. He asked me to discuss what types of nuclear plants would be good for other than base load generation. For those of you who are not familiar with electrical system operations, I'll give a little background. The 24-hour load profile for most electrical systems has a double hump shape, with a morning peak when people get up, take showers, and cook breakfast, and when daytime factories and businesses energize lighting and industrial loads. After that morning peak, the load drops a little bit during the middle of the day and then rises again in the afternoon and evening due to heating and air conditioning demands and when people return home at night, begin cooking, watching television, and using computers. The load drops late in the evening and is the lowest in the dead of night. Different types of power plants are needed in order to reliably supply energy to this ever-changing load. There are typically three types of generation in an electrical system: base load plants, power plants that load follow, and peaking units. Baseload plants are the cheapest producers and they run full power day in and day out. Coal and nuclear plants generally fall into this category because they produce the lowest cost energy and because they're larger and they don't change load as quickly as other kinds of plants. Load following is the next level of generator, and as the name implies, they follow the load. They sit in standby or at low power when the system load is low, and as load goes up, they increase power to match it. Then they ramp back down again when the load reduces. Load following plants are usually oil or gas fired, but some nuclear plants around the world do in fact load follow, particularly in areas like France, where a large percentage of the total generation comes from nuclear plants. Peaking units are usually the most expensive producers and they only generate electricity when the system load peaks, such as on very hot or very cold days, or when there are supply or load imbalances, such as when a large base load unit shuts down unexpectedly. Peaking units have to be able to start up on demand and pick up load rapidly. Peaking units are usually gas turbines, diesel generators, and sometimes oil-fired units. You'll hear the phrase spinning reserve used to describe plants that are essentially idling at zero power with their turbine generators spinning. They're in standby so they can pick up load in a hurry when it's needed. And in some markets, power plants get paid a premium to be in spinning reserve because they're needed for grid stability. There's also the question of voltage control in the system that's related to load control, but that'll have to wait for another show. So the question is, what kind of nuclear plants would be suitable for load following or peaking? As I mentioned before, some current day nuclear plants do load follow, but it's not the norm in most systems. The pressurized water reactors and boiling water reactors that I'm familiar with have some operating characteristics that make repetitive up and down transients a little difficult to manage. It can be done, but it does add to the cost and to the complexity of operations. I'm not that familiar with the CANDU reactors to know how well they load follow, so maybe some of you out in Canada or in India can post something in the show notes about CANDUs and load following. To be good for following the load, a plant would need to be able to easily and economically go up and down from low power to full power and back twice per day. There are some good reactor designs for this. Marine propulsion reactors, for example, are designed to change power level very rapidly. They could even be used in spinning reserve and do load peaking, but that might not be economical. Smaller gas-cooled reactors, particularly those tied to gas turbines, would be good load followers. The pebble bed modular reactor, for example, might be an ideal load follower if it were coupled to either a gas turbine or a steam turbine system designed for rapid power changes. The Adams atomic engine would also be a good load follower. There's a link in the show notes to Adams atomic engine. The nice thing about using smaller modular units is that you can have a chain of reactors and you start up as many or as few as you need depending on system load. That's ideal for areas with isolated transmission or distribution systems, such as we just spoke about in Nigeria. And while I'm not certain, the barge-mounted Russian reactors might be good load followers because they're based on marine propulsion reactors. Again, if any of you listening have experience in that reactor type, let me know. So, Avram, that's my take on the best nuclear plants for other than baseload energy production. Thanks for the great question. There's a new player in the USA's nuclear renaissance. Alternative Energy Holdings, Incorporated, this week announced they plan to build a new nuclear plant near Bruno, Idaho. The board of directors includes Ralph Beadle, a past senior vice president of the Nuclear Energy Institute, Ken Strom, a former president of IMPO, and Don Gillespie, a senior nuclear executive who's serving as the company's president and chief executive officer. The press release states they plan to build a 1,500-megawatt plant and will start construction in 2008. I'm not sure exactly what they mean by beginning construction in 2008, because it'll take longer than that to obtain a combined construction and operating license. Perhaps they mean site characterization and field work starting at the proposed site in 2008. Hope to get some more details on that soon. Another news article I read indicates that some of the proposed reactor's low-quality heat would be used to supply energy to a biodiesel manufacturing plant. If so, that'd be a really innovative combination of two energy forms. Makes great sense, too, because the low-cost energy from the reactor will make the biodiesel cheaper and more competitive with petroleum-based fuel. And the city of Fresno, California, announced this week that they're interested in building and operating a nuclear plant for their municipal energy customers. That's going to be tough because under the current California state law, no nuclear plants can be built until the state's Energy Commission determines that a technology has been demonstrated for the disposal of used fuel. You could argue that the waste isolation pilot plant's done that, but you'd have to convince the California Energy Commission. State law can be changed, though, and perhaps it will, in light of California's leadership in limiting greenhouse gas emissions. History's proven that state and local governments are not very effective at efficiently building and operating the current vintage of large commercial nuclear plants. They just don't have the skill set or the areas of expertise. They could make it happen, though, in Fresno through a partnership with an experienced nuclear operating company. That kind of arrangement would work well there because it would give the Fresno nuclear plant access to the operating experience and other advantages of being part of a fleet of plants. That way they can enjoy low-cost, emissions-free electricity that nuclear energy has to offer without the burden of trying to build an operating organization to support it. There's been a lot of recent experience with this business model, with lessons learned to build upon. A few that come to mind are the nuclear management company that operates power plants in the U.S. Midwest, Exelon's agreement to operate the Salem Hope Creek plants, and Entergy, who manages the operation of the Cooper Nuclear Station for Nebraska Public Power. David Lochbaum of the anti-nuclear group, the Union of Concerned Scientists, is promoting a 25-year-old study that theorized that a Boeing 707 airplane crash into a nuclear plant could cause a core meltdown and radiation release. And he's using this dated analysis to support his arguments that nuclear plants are unsafe. Here's David Lochbaum describing his concerns.
Nuclear power is a high-risk technology that has always had well-known and well-feared safety risks that have recently been complemented by the risk of terrorism. There's now a security threat in addition to the well-established safety threat. The safety threats of nuclear power are the tremendous amounts of radioactive materials that are in a confined space that could be released if an accident occurred. The 103 nuclear power plants that are operating in the United States today are a safety and security threat. Unless we properly manage that threat, people can get hurt. A lot of people can get hurt. U.S. nuclear power plants were built with the concept of an aircraft strike in mind, but it was an accidental crash. We didn't envision the 9/11 type suicide attack, and none of the plants in the United States were built to withstand that type of attack. Since 9/11, all we've done to protect our nuclear power plants from that kind of attack is to upgrade airport security. That's it. Nuclear power plants containing thousands of curies of radioactive materials located close to large population centers are particularly vulnerable parts of the infrastructure that our enemies may try to exploit against us.
That was David Lochbaum describing his concerns over airplane crashes into nuclear plants. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission dismissed Lochbaum's allegations as irrelevant and unfounded. I've considered the arguments here, and I have to agree with the NRC for a number of reasons. Let me give you just one example of why Mr. Lochbaum's conclusions are out of date. He quotes a part of a study that says if an airplane crashed into the control room of a nuclear plant, there could be a meltdown because the operators would be dead, or they'd lose control of the reactor and be unable to shut it down and keep it cool. That's false for several reasons. Nuclear plants have a fail-safe design, so any kind of disaster like this would disturb the cooling system, the electrical system, or other vital systems that would cause the reactor to automatically shut down, and the emergency cooling systems would automatically start. Next, the 1982 study that Lochbaum refers to was done before the alternate shutdown capabilities were added to U.S. nuclear plants. This feature provides the ability to safely shut down the plant and keep the reactor cool from remote locations outside of the control room in protected areas. If an airplane hit the control room, then the operators who work outside in the plant would be able to take control of the reactor, shut it down, and keep it cool. These features were retrofitted to all existing nuclear plants in the 1980s, maybe even into the early 90s, but I think it was done by the late 80s. And it was designed into all the new ones. The 1982 study also assumed that there would be, quote, no operator intervention, a ridiculous assumption because it ignores the realistic timeline of any such disaster. There are emergency procedures and contingency plans in place to provide many, many ways to keep the reactor cool, and it's ridiculous to assume that the people whose responsibility it is to carry out those plans would simply ignore the situation and walk away. Many of these hypothetical core damage scenarios take many hours to get to the point that radiation is released, and that provides ample time for a whole variety of pre-planned compensatory actions to be put in place. When nuclear engineers and plant designers consider what would happen in a nuclear accident, they usually start with an assumption of no operator action. They run the scenario out to its end to see if there's any core damage or any radiation release without operator action. Then, if a particular scenario does yield core damage, they go back in and add the reasonable operator actions and other barriers to counter the accident. Very often, people who are opposed to nuclear power use these no-action scenarios as the basis for claiming that plants run safe. The concepts of nuclear plant safety and security were the highlight of remarks made by Rudy Giuliani recently, the highly respected former mayor of New York and expert on emergency preparedness and security, spoke out in favor of the Indian Point nuclear plant's application for a life extension. Here's what he had to say.
Thank you very much, Dr. Moore and Jerry and Mike Chancellor and Mayor. Thank you for having us here in Yonkers. I'm going to address myself to first a narrow issue and then make one or two comments on the broader one. The narrow issue, which is a really important one, obviously, is safety and security. Giuliani Partners has been working with Entergy since 2003, which is quite some time now. And the whole purpose of our engagement, which would include Tom Von Essen, who was the former fire commissioner, and Richie Shearer, who was the former head of the Mayor's Office of Emergency Management, and Maureen Casey, who was a former deputy commissioner of the police department, all of whom work on this project with Entergy. The whole purpose of it is to make sure that the safety and security at Entergy is at Indian Point is state-of-the-art, so that it is the best security that's available. There is nothing that produces energy that doesn't carry risk. In fact, there isn't much in life that doesn't carry risk. And the real question for safety and security is, what procedures do you have? How do you make it as safe as possible? How do you minimize the risk of accident or attack? And Entergy is kind of ahead, and so is the nuclear industry. I'm not just Entergy, but the nuclear industry is kind of probably ahead of most industries in this country. And in fact, if the safety and security that existed at Indian Point and other similar kinds of nuclear plants existed at other industrial facilities, we would probably be at the level of safety and security that we really want to be at. Or the other way of saying it is, they've been at this business much, much longer than most other industries. It's been a part of nuclear power from the very, very beginning. They've had to emphasize safety and security. They've developed procedures and codes and hiring of people that is at a much higher level than in most other industries. In fact, when Dr. Moore mentioned about real estate and finance, I looked at Mike Hess and I said, we should be doing safety and security for them. There's a lot more people who need it. But the reality is that We have participated with them in at least 12 drills, including a force-on-force drill. This is just in the last couple of years. They have invested over $24 million specifically in safety and security improvements. What that means is trying to have the best limitation of access and perimeter security for the plant, making sure that the people who work there are safe, making sure they're the right people, background checks, that sort of thing, protocols on evacuation, protocols on notification. They have also been a very, very big participant in the Hawthorne Center, which is a state project, but it's a state-of-the-art communication center, which would be used if there ever were an accident or a problem with regard to nuclear power, but it can be used for anything else. It's so, in essence, the presence of this issue here means that safety and security and communication is enhanced for anything else that might happen, whether it's a natural disaster or some other form of attack, which is something we have to consider. Entergy has invested a tremendous amount of time and energy in trying to determine how do you have the best security, how do you have the best safety, and every one of the recommendations we've made to them, they have accepted or in some cases even improved on. So from the point of view of safety and security, I think with regard to the kind of professional review they go through, they're going to be found, as they have in the past, to be complying with not just the minimum standards, but the higher standards. On the broader issue of the need for nuclear power, I just got back from India. And the second time this year I was in India, and Mike Hess and I were in China a year ago. And the reality is I was in India when the Senate approved the agreement between the United States and India to enhance nuclear power in India. China is going to build 30, I think, maybe 35 nuclear power facilities over the next decade, decade and a half. India wants to do that. That's part of the idea of this agreement. France, I think nuclear power is 70-80% of the needs in France are supplied by nuclear power. And the United States hasn't had a new nuclear facility in 25 years. This is a necessary part of our being energy independent. If you build a nuclear power plant, then you don't have to rely on some other maybe volatile part of the world for your energy. You're in control of it. And as Dr. Moore points out, if your concern is the environment, and if you go to India or China, you can see what's happening to the environment there, then you've got to go in the direction, to some extent, of nuclear power. You've got to provide the safety and security like Entergy has been doing. It has to be a major investment of money and time and effort. But, I mean, there are just realities that have to be faced. And I think the mayor here has pointed out the percentage of power here in Yonkers, but New York City depends on Indian Point. It would, in a realistic sense, it would be impossible to get through the summers, much less the vagaries that sometimes happen in having our power come from far away if you didn't have Indian Point. So that's the broader issue. Our narrower concern and our area of expertise is safety and security, and our view of it is that Indian Point is as safe as a facility can be and a pretty good model, if not an excellent model, for not only other nuclear power plants but for other industries to reach to that level of security. And other industries that are, in many ways, just as sensitive. So we'd be happy to answer any questions, and we'll be working with Entergy throughout the process, throughout the regulatory process, to allay any concerns that people have about security. Or, as happens in the security field, 6 months from now, and a year from now, and a year from and a half from now, state-of-the-art security might be different than it is today. Better procedures, better technology, better identification procedures, and they've been right at the cutting edge in trying to have that level of security. So I guess the point of that is the safety and security that exists now, next year, the year after that, is even going to be better. So thank you very much.
That was Rudolph Giuliani on nuclear plant safety and security and the value that Indian Point provides to New York and the U.S. Northeast. Quite a contrast between Rudy and Dave Lochbaum, don't you think? My last show, episode 38, generated a ton of listener response. I must have received about a dozen emails with all kinds of great suggestions and observations. Here are a few. Two listeners, Ken G. and Tom P., pointed out that burning biodiesel in combustion turbines is probably break even from the perspective of CO2 gas emissions, because the soybeans absorb CO2 when growing and then return it to the air when it's burned. The particulate and other air polluting emissions would still need to be dealt with, but these are excellent points. Thanks, Ken and Tom. Dave M. wrote that Indian Point has a number of other somewhat unique safety features that provide enhanced accident response. One example of this is their internal containment recirc pumps. Dave promised to join us on a future show to discuss this in more detail. Thanks, Dave. And one listener asked if I'm related to John Archibald Wheeler, the renowned nuclear physicist. Unfortunately, not. While we share names and similar passions, we're not related, at least not to my knowledge. But if you're listening out there, Dr. Wheeler, give me a call. It'd be great to have you on the show. And not everybody was happy with episode 38. If you've taken a look at my blog and show transcript number 38, you'll see that the blogger who calls himself Pinto Bean and Porgy Tirebiter posted some very critical comments. He's the blogger that I mentioned in episode 38. He apparently lives around Indian Point, and I invited him to join in on the debate and to post links to documents he claims to have about unsafe conditions at the plant. So far, he's declined to do that. He did, however, do a piece on me in his Washington Scandal blog, where he claimed to have uncovered a, quote, secret industry mole. Well, if you've been listening to my show for a while, you'll get about as big a kick out of that as I did. I've been podcasting and blogging for about a year now, and as far back as episode number one, I made it very clear that I work in the nuclear industry. And I've also always used my real name, not an alias. Porgy Tirebiter also has the mistaken impression that I anonymously posted inappropriate comments to one of his blogs. That's puzzling to me. Why would I want to do that when factual and courteous blog posts generate friendly but heated debates? And it's that kind of interactivity that makes this new media such a fantastic tool for sharing thoughts and ideas. I'll put a link to Porgy's blog in the show notes. I thought it was nice of him to put my photo right on the same page with that of Senator Evan Bayh and just below Rudy Giuliani's. At least I'm in good company. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening to the show. Don't forget you can stop by the website at thisweekinnuclear.com, where you can search and read show transcripts and listen to prior episodes. You can also support the show by visiting advertisers' links and shopping at my Amazon storefront. Thanks again for listening to episode number 39 of This Week in Nuclear. This is John Wheeler. For those of you celebrating holidays over the next several days, wish you well. Have a safe holiday, and see you next time on This Week in Nuclear.